Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. Meet John Chad, creator of the Leo Geo graphic novel series and cartoonist behind Volcanoes, the newest installment in First Second's Science Comics series. Welcome to All the Wonders, the Children's Book Podcast. I'm Matthew Winner. This is episode number 337 of the podcast with John Chad. Something funny happens with me when I read nonfiction. I realize just how little I know about a given topic. And then, if I might have the opportunity to interview the author of said nonfiction title, you can expect me to completely nerd out and wonder over the topic and this opportunity to speak with an authority on the subject. And so, without further ado, I present to you Evidence Exhibit A, a really wonderful conversation with cartoonist John Chad about comics, volcanoes, and an underlying love for science. Here's episode number 337 of the podcast with John Chad. Welcome to the podcast, John Chad. I'm excited to talk to you tonight.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
You know, we talked over email before this, and I purposefully didn't say this before we started recording, but you, my friend, author of Leo Geo, are beloved in my library, and probably all libraries, because your book sticks out like 4 inches from the shelf. Wonderful for people that don't know. So you're the comic that I know you best from, Leo Geo. The dimensions are cut so wide and thin when it sits on the shelf that it is extra wide. And then as you read it, you sort of open it tall, like a long scrolling, I don't know, grocery store receipt, and Leo Geo digs his way to the center of the earth and out through again. But It is a force, that book. It is amazing.
Well, thank you. I get notes and I talk to librarians that either fall into the, you know, like, oh, the we enjoy the book, we love that it's about science, you know, and it's tactile, you know, the kids have to move the form of the book around, you know, but then they'll always add in, but it's such a beast to shelve. It's
yeah, but do you know it's because of the trim size that I think gets that book noticed constantly? Constantly. That book is took out off the shelf because it sticks out and says, notice me. Mm-hmm. I love that. We have another book in our library called Lincoln Shot, which is this nonfiction book about Abraham Lincoln. And it's all told newspaper style in the dimensions of newspapers of the time. So you can't shelve it. You have to like lay it down on its spine for it to go on the shelf. And when you do, it sticks out another like 6 inches.
So are you saying like it's like super big?
Yeah, super big, super tall. It's maybe, it's not twice the size of a normal picture book, but it's at least a head taller. And because of that dimension, you just sort of have it on display all the time.
Yeah.
And then it's circulated all the time. So in that way, I think that design of it, though it does, it sort of purposefully, as art should, it purposefully interrupts the flow of things. It causes you to notice it. And in that way, causes readers to pick it up, which is cool. So bravo for Leo Geo for that.
Well, thank you.
Also, I mean, it's awesome. We had Leo Geo, so I'm in Maryland, and Leo was one of our nominees in our state book award, our Black Eyed Susan graphic novel award, the inaugural year of having that award, the award that we picked 10 nominees, and all of our Maryland students read these graphic novels throughout the year and then choose, they vote on their favorite. And so your book got read and read by in that year, so many librarians and students. And we use that list also as a way to help librarians that are sort of unsure of what graphic novels to buy, using it as like a core collection list. So,
I had no idea. I'm embarrassed. That's amazing.
No, so I say that to say, John, that has always been a book that I feel like is a book that belongs in every school library. The way that you obviously respect science and the quest for knowledge is so apparent in both of your Leo Geo books. And the reason why you're here tonight, we're talking about Science Comics, your Volcanoes book in the Science Comics series. It's just apparent how much you respect science and I can only assume love asking questions and seeking answers, whether or not you find them.
Yeah, I really, you know, if I was to go back in time 10 years and say that I would be doing the majority of my work would be science comics, I think I would have readily believed you because I think I've always had this kind of underlying love of science and this underlying love of understanding how the world works. There's this really funny home video of me when I'm young I'm on this like a fair ride. It's like kind of like you're on these flying helicopters and you're going around a circle and you can make the thing go up and down, but you're always just going in a clockwise. And whoever is holding the camera is desperately, desperately trying to get my attention. But I'm not listening to them. I'm looking at the machine that's running the ride. And I'm just like enthralled with the gears and the mechanisms and the hydraulics. And I think that that's like a nice illustration of my fascination with science. I love it in that it is like the gears of the world around us.
Yeah, I could see that. And also thank you for bringing me back to Hershey Park, because that's where I remember riding those rides with the helicopter going up and down, and how if you pull it straight up, it sort of like bounces at the top.
Yes, yes.
as the pump reaches the full extension.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, yeah, no. I would just be sitting there going up and down, just like, if I do this, what happens? If I do this, what happens? And then just feeling the result.
Well, so to be a kid that has always been asking those questions and has been, you know, that little scientist in your own mind or in your own world, I mean, where were comics for you? Where was reading for you? Let me back up to that before we jump into your Volcanoes book. Mm-hmm. Were you also like a scientific reader as a child, looking at books to learn more? Because you and I might have more of a connection than I realized. I loved digging into Seymour Simon's books about the universe and about all these different science topics because of these bold photographs and such. So I wonder if reading played a role in your curiosity as well.
It was. There's a couple of standout books, namely the David McCulley books. Those were like, you know, those were so important to me growing up. It influenced the level of detail that I would look at a subject, and also influenced like the level of detail that I would simply draw a subject. You know, from Leo Geo, I've drawn more rocks than you know anything. And I feel like, yeah, just poring over those drawings was really important to me. But besides that, like, I'm not a strong reader. I read a lot of fantasy and science fiction when I was a kid, and I think it was maybe more of my love of gaming and role playing that actually maybe informed more of my quest for like scientific investigation.
Cool.
Well, because. Well, you know, you'd be sitting down and you'd want to make a character, you'd want to devise a game, and, you know, the best, you know, fiction comes from nonfiction in a way. And so I would kind of like look at you know, how can these things influence a story? How could the science behind, you know, glaciers influence a story in the Arctic? How could, you know, what does armor look like in Japan? And stuff like that, you know, that, I think that was a little bit more of where science came into my life, a little less so than reading.
That's a cool cross section though, to have it that way, to have it, be so visually driven.
Mm-hmm.
Through the illustrations, through the things you see in the games, through the story that are told in the games that way. That's cool. So you come from there into making comics. And whatever the path was that brought you there, I'm happy to jump back there in a moment. But where we are now, your newest release with First Second is part of the Science comic series that they've done so well with so far. And you did Volcanoes, Fire, and Life. And man, oh man, this was like, yeah, this was an intense trip. First off, I'm like, okay, cool, Volcanoes. I am a fanboy of everything that First Second does. Let's see how you approach this. But to start off essentially in a volcano book, placing us in a world that's just essentially completely frozen over, all ice, just devoid of all heat and fire elements whatsoever, was the hook for me. Just, oh, okay, I see how you're gonna play this game. I like this, John. This is fun.
Well, I you know, I initially did it because I was, you know, I can't do anything besides color and draw a book to make it feel hot, right? Like I can't, the technology doesn't exist yet for me to make a book that actually projects heat. And so I figured that like maybe the strongest way that I could make these volcanoes and all the hot, violent activity that goes inside of the earth, that I could really make it feel palpable and tangible, is to set it against such a contrasting backdrop of like a frozen future. But they're also setting it in a frozen post-apocalyptic future also had an unintended consequence that I'm really, really happy about. And it's that it created a setting where the knowledge that the main character, Aurora, is looking to learn, she's looking to learn about volcanoes, the knowledge is constantly being questioned by those around her, because based on their evidence, the claims that she's making that volcanoes exist, that volcanoes, you know, erupt magma and ash and gas and all these hot materials, they don't see it. All they see is a world that's frozen over. They see glaciers, they see ice and snow. And I actually think that that environment is really important in the acquisition and the study of science. The idea that when you're learning something and it might be challenged, you know, you might get conflicting bits of evidence. What you observe might be different than what the truth might actually be. And so setting it in that kind of frozen future kind of set the stage for that. It allowed for an environment where it was very easy for the other characters to say like, oh, we don't believe you, you know, show us the proof. And that spurred the main character on, that encouraged her to intensify her explanations, to make them more complicated and more specific, and to find evidence to justify it to them.
Yeah, I love that it's in this world where they're searching all of the abandoned buildings and the just whatever things they can find that'll burn. They're looking for anything that'll burn. And the idea that for them there could be something so far out of their grasp of understanding. Something that could burn so hot, that could melt rock, that could do the incredible things the volcanoes do. You're right, to take us back there feels like you're taking us back to a place where you know, we were being told, you know, the world might actually be round. And no, there's no way it has to be flat. It's impossible for it to be round. It just feels like, well, I mean, there's these parallels too, right? To everything we're talking about now, that the science that we're discovering and all the things that we don't know yet, but just because we don't believe it can happen doesn't mean that it can't. We discover new things every day that we never thought were possible.
Yeah. It also, you know, you know, I think that people think of the Earth as like something that's, you know, it's a rock, and a rock by virtue of not being sentient is thought of as dead, right? And kind of setting it in a frozen Earth even makes that more apparent, that like the Earth is something dead, it's something inert. But volcanoes are proof that the Earth is just like this vibrant, living, you know, exciting force, you know, that's constantly changing.
It's changing and growing, yeah.
And you know, I would be hard pressed, I think, to find a child or anybody who did not know like what a volcano was or what like lava was. But if I can get them to approach it with new eyes and get them excited about them and not see them as just like just a mountain that spits up lava.
Well, no, yeah, I mean you go and describe all of the different kinds of volcanoes that there are, and that for me was so enlightening to understand about lava and the viscosity of lava and about how all this different makeup working together leads to different volcanoes and different reactions and different eruptions. And I walked away from this book, one of my favorite experiences was that there would be points of such intense learning where I was like, oh my word, I know nothing about volcanoes.
Oh,
and
I know.
John is telling me everything. And then there was just, you gave like a moment to breathe. Like, okay, let's just have her friends question her too. That way me, the reader, I felt like I was like, oh good, I'm not the only one that thinks this is crazy. These people from the future, from the future ice world, also are questioning. I feel better.
that specific fact that you referenced, that like blew the whole thing open for me. Like when I learned about the interconnective nature between like magma viscosity, volcano shape, and, you know, eruption strength, that was like easily like 300% more than I'd ever learned about volcanoes. Like just that one fact.
I had no idea. I had no idea.
And I mean, because of the way that I was taught about volcanoes, I was taught like, oh, there's a cone volcano. Like there's a composite volcano. There's a dome volcano. And I knew that there was different types. But the way that they were described and presented to me, it was almost as if, and you know, kids love this analogy, as if they're Pokemon, right? As if they are different specific creatures that, you know, like there's a fox, there's a squirrel, there's a chipmunk.
Yeah.
But in reality, it's a gradation. It's a sliding scale, and it all is based on magma viscosity. You know, a volcano can start as one type of volcano because of the viscosity, and then over time, the mineral composition of the magma can change, and the volcano can become steeper. And so these things, again, they aren't static. They aren't the same. You know, they're changing and they're growing. And yeah, when I go around and do school visits, like if I can walk away with them learning like one thing about volcanoes, it's like magma viscosity.
I think that to see that, that when you change them, this is like a good scientific experiment, isn't it? That when you have these two different variables and you adjust one up one way and one down the other way, that it results in a different reaction. That it, sometimes this is going to result in a huge explosion that'll shoot the tons and tons and tons of ash. I had no idea. My word. When you were describing Pompeii, I think we all have a working memory of Pompeii from what we hear about, like, oh yeah, that was the city that was destroyed by the volcano. But to hear that there was ash that crushed houses, my word. There were moments like that. Some of my favorite moments were the way you pair the concept of, okay, here's a volcano and here's what makes this one different. There's this amount of pressure, or the landform is shaped in such a way that it causes the eruption to look like this. And then you sort of walk through like in Japan where there's this one, or in wherever where there's this other one. When you draw from those references around the world, for me, weirdly, the experience I had was, oh my word, I thought there were like five volcanoes in the world, and there's way more than that.
Oh yeah. Oh, and it's because also there, a lot of them are so different, you know, and you know, when you include inactive and dormant volcanoes, you know, you might just be looking at a mountain. You know, what did I learn? Oh God, there's a word for the type of mountains that are around the school that I teach. And I kept on seeing the word, God, this is going to kill me that I can't remember. But it turned out that it was like, it was referencing like its volcanic origins, like just like Mount Ascutney, like had, you know, these obscure volcanic origins or whatever. God, I feel like I'm gonna go crazy. I can't remember it.
I love that even after doing a volcano book, you're still like driven by the language and the questions. This was a book right away, to just call it out, John, that I felt like I need to read this like 3 more times. And it is very readable in that way too. We could just sit here and name off facts, but for me to know that the way that the ash is different, in volcanic eruptions, that it's like jagged ash and that it's so small that, it can get into everything to have ash that's smaller than your hair, the width of your hair, the facts like that that you're dropping on us are just, it make it to me, it makes me admire you even more. I should put it this way, to take the breadth of facts that you had here, and to be able to work them into one story, one, reference piece about volcanoes. You've made this resource so robust, and also there's this side story about the post-apocalyptic world going on within this story to contextualize everything. There's just so much there that, I don't know, I really admire the way that you pulled off this book. It really took a lot of thought, and you pulled it off very well.
Well, thank you. You know, we're talking about all these facts, you know, and how they relate to the narrative. I think one of the things the narrative does that was really imperative for me was that it helped make the book not feel like this kind of doom and gloom. You know, all the facts that you've been saying, like the, you know, volcanic ash is like 1/100th of the width of a piece of human hair. It's like totally terrifying. There's these things called lahars that are like mudslides that are ash mixed with water. It would be very easy for this book to like to have people just like tearing their hair out after every page. but I didn't want to approach it. And I think that I didn't want to approach it like that. I didn't want people to walk away from this just being like completely terrified from volcanoes. Now they are dangerous. I want to make that very clear. But you know, they're also like a part of the earth. You know, they're part of nature. They're a geological formation. They're they're evidence that the earth is moving and that the mantle is hot and kicking right along. And I didn't want this whole book to seem like just a laundry list of the terrible things that volcanoes can do to you.
Well, but at the same time, there's so much awe and wonder at the magnitude of the strength of volcanoes and the size and what they do. I mean, you strike that balance really well. I think even to go from that power back to how quiet the world that Aurora lives in is, that it's they're digging through this abandoned building. They find all these books that they're scanning to upload into that database so they can sort of maintain all the knowledge of the world. And that's how we come upon this volcano book and have all that classified information, the information that's being kept from her. But to go back to that quiet world where really the only thing making noise are the company that Aurora keeps, that's questioning her or that is blaming her for certain things. I think to go back and forth between those two things is just, I don't know, it's just something that works. It's something that works really well, and something that, I don't know, that you striking that balance between the doom and gloom and the awe that happens. I mean, this is fire, melted rock shooting from the ground, people. come on. And I can tell that you like drawing this kind of stuff because there were lots of really cool like camera shots of the different explosions in the different mountains. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of really neat geographic illustrations in this that I thought painted a really great picture of scale for the reader.
Well, thank you. I mean, that was just like a drawing problem. You know, how do you give drama to something that sits there and by nature doesn't move? You know, it's like, it's remarkable how much emotion you can get out of Darth Vader, just how you tilt his helmet, just like how you look at him. And yes. I think, I discovered the same thing with volcanoes, right? Like, when you're up close and they're erupting, it feels more violent. They feel more deadly and more ominous. When you're pulled back, you know, the eruption can be very explosive, but it just feels more natural, feels more purposeful. So yeah, like playing around with different angles, that was a necessity. Otherwise, it would just be like the Garfield strip of mountains, right? Just like the same shot every time.
Well, yeah. I need to back up. I need to ask you about you approaching this book, about you researching. I want to know about this book from the start, John. So I know you mentioned that that First Second approached you about making a comic on this topic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that where we start? Is that?
Yeah, they emailed me and they asked if I would be interested in tackling a book about volcanoes. And I think I really love the earth sciences, as evidenced by my first book, Leo Geo. And so I was – the idea of tackling volcanology with 120 pages of specificity felt really, really good. And so then I came up with a couple different like general ideas for how the story would be. Because at the end of the day, like, I still want people to walk away and like feel like they read a good story.
Right.
And so, you know, God, I had one where it was like, you know, it was a race of dinosaur people and they like their planet was covered in volcanoes, but they didn't know like how volcanoes worked. And so they sent like their youngest, you know, cute dinosaur member to Earth to like learn about volcanoes. There was one where like volcanoes were hit by interstellar rays that turned them into like walking, talking like personas, because I'm really fascinated about how like you can draw these like emotive characteristics out of volcanoes. And so it would be like a Karate Kid style tournament where these volcanoes would kind of like, you know, give facts about each other and beat each other up.
Oh, that's cool.
But I think that this one won out just because that contrast was so strong and it lent itself to some really striking visuals. Yeah. So I jumped into the research, and the first thing I did was, you know, whenever I'm facing like a larger research project, like with the first Leo Geo or with this book, or, you know, the second Leo Geo book, it can feel really daunting to kind of look at a subject in its entirety and kind of know where to start. And so what I do is I tend to write down what I know, or at least I think I know, and then I write down questions based on what I know, questions that are maybe more specific in nature about the subject, or questions that simply clarify the facts that I know. And oftentimes I find that I'm wrong. I'm just plain wrong. Through the process of answering those like kind of core questions, I can kind of get my footing into what is the necessary elements of the topic. And with volcanoes, that's what led me to magma viscosity. And the question that got me there was I wrongfully assumed that all volcanoes were the same, that in essence they were the same, but they simply look different. And maybe those differences were based on the local geology. And that was like what I thought I knew.
Yep.
And so I asked, like, okay, well then does that mean that volcanoes are basically regional? Basically, you know, where you find them, they will be different. And then of course I find out everything about, you know, the makeup of magma, and I realized I was entirely wrong. and that really was the central focal point for my research. And then from then I can kind of like spider out, but things kind of naturally will kind of tie back in to themselves. And what that helped with is it stopped me from kind of going down rabbit holes that wouldn't connect back to the initial core of like what I was trying to get across. They wouldn't just be too facts that became too isolated or disconnected.
That makes sense. I mean, and to lead this on a path that was connected that way, knowing that your readers are these like elementary school to middle school age kids, knowing what they may already know or what questions they may ask, I feel like knowing that you came from questioning makes sense reading the text, because it feels like you're starting at first at that place of like, whoa, there were things that exploded from the ground, to getting around to what causes the explosion. And then, as you're saying, mm-hmm. how things can change and form into different formations based on that viscosity. So that coming from questions to write the text, I think mirrors what your reader would be doing as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also it was really important, like how I went about the research. My first bout of like kind of, you know, trying to answer these questions and figuring out what I know and what I didn't know, I was relying a lot on internet sources. And my partner teaches in an independent school, and I was talking to her about this, and she said, you know, John, I really think it's important that you research this project the way that you would want a kid reading this to research a project.
There you go.
And I was like, yeah, you're so right. And so I immediately like, you know, went to the library. I got out a ton of books. I got out some movies, you know, and I reached out. I went through my like personal Rolodex of friends, and I had totally forgotten that I had met two geologists in line at a friend's wedding.
So, what?
Yeah, they had gotten Leo Geo through this particular friend, and so we were talking about it, and they, you know, I was like, oh, you're French and Gwen, like you're the two geologists that Alec knows, and we were talking about it, and then you know, circle wipe, Star Wars style to later. I'm like, you know, doing a book about volcanoes, and I was like, oh, I should call them up, and they were super. They were such lifesavers, because they were able to do that like final layer of synthesizing and distillation that I was trying to do with these facts, where I'm taking all these different sources, all these different, you know, these facts, and kind of trying to funnel them into one coherent line. And sometimes I would simplify things too much, and sometimes I wouldn't simplify things enough. And they were really generous with their time to look over my script and my inks and kind of both semantically and visually say like, oh, you know, you're being a little too specific here, or, oh, you're not being specific enough. And that was a really important part. You know, I talk to kids when I do school visits about how, you know, it might seem crazy that I've drawn these comic pages like four times by the time that I'm doing the final pages. You know, I do thumbnails, I do pencils, and then I do inks. But it's just like rough drafts of a report, you know, and in between those drafts, I'm showing them to people who are my teachers in a way, and I'm getting feedback. And so that was, yeah, I'd never done something that long and that research intensive. But the combination of, you know, varying my sources, going to the library and having people to double check my work, just, it went a lot smoother than I could have ever hoped. It was a lot of fun too.
So let me ask, a sort of specific thing, and I do want to compliment you for and your geologist friends for the balance of language. I feel like there is science. When we talk about science, there's scientific language. We need to have specific language to mm-hmm. reference so that we know what we're talking about. And also because you have kids that are going to nerd out over this, and they want the exact language. They don't want to be talked down to. So mm-hmm. this gives them that jumping off platform. But when you were mapping out, when you were thumbnailing this story, what's your process of thumbnailing? Like, I picture all of this research that you have, that sort of finding the right amount of pacing to explain yourself enough without having to like cram it into a certain number of pages. I guess what I'm trying to ask is, did you write mm-hmm. the ice story, Aurora story, in tandem with the facts? Did you find that they balance each other themselves out, or how did you, I don't know, how did you get that right?
Well, I do my first round of thumbnails on the entire book is on two pieces of 8.5 by 11 paper, and they're very, very small, and it's just like blocking out shapes. But really I'm just like looking at the story in large chunks, and I'm thinking, okay, like the first part, you know, about, you know, what do I want to get across? I guess to answer your question, the volcano stuff took precedent. You know, it's like the first bit of information I want is, you know, what types of or where are volcanoes found and how do they operate? How are they formed? And then what different types are there? Then what are their eruption types like? And then what are the things that can come as a result of those eruptions? And finally, like kind of the odds and ends. The last bit of the book is a little bit odds and endsy. And then what I did is I kind of looked at each of those parts and I was like, okay, well, what kind of narrative beats can be structured around this? You know, when I'm talking about eruptions, you know, that's when I really get into the idea of like volcanoes having personalities, right? You have like something that's quiet and subdued and almost gentle, like a shield volcano with very weak eruptions, versus something like a Plinian eruption, like Pompeii or Mount St. Helen.
And to pair that, John, with your characters, to say, oh, the way that I've driven them to this point, they're now reacting to me, to Aurora, these different ways, I thought was a really neat connection to tie it into people that we might know that are like that. I think as a sort of a mnemonic device, too, it helps to remember these volcano types as individuals that way.
Yeah, well, it helps personify and give life and excitement to something that is otherwise, you know, a pile of rocks. But it's basically that process, like, for every scene. You know, I would take, you know, a bit of facts and say, okay, like, what sort of narrative beat would this complement? You know, what goal narratively could this bit of information fulfill? And you know, that blend is something I'm very, very passionate about and still working at. I still think I'm trying to master that blend of like fact and fiction. And, you know, if you could get it in the same sentence, that's ideal, you know, as opposed to having a segment of fact, a segment of fiction, a segment of fact, a segment of fiction. You know, as often as I can, like, blend them together on the same page, that's like a real success for me.
Yeah.
There's this have you seen the 2004 Fantastic Four movie?
Yes.
Okay, there's a scene that's like incredibly formative for me. This is like a very important scene. Dr. Doom has captured Mr. Fantastic. And for your listeners, Mr. Fantastic has like stretching powers, right? He's kind of like rubber. Dr. Doom has him captured and has him tied to a chair, and he's pumping this like gas over him. And there's a bottle next to him that says like, liquid nitrogen.
Yeah.
And Dr. Doom just, he's interrogating him. And then he very casually says like, you know, what happens when you super cool rubber? And then he goes over to Mr. Fantastic and he like bends up his finger and it gives off this like crackling, like breaking noise. And it's causing Mr. Fantastic a lot of pain. But he never answers his own question. but then I'm sitting there, you know, like I'm 18 years old. I've gone through all of high school, but it just then dawns on me. It's like, oh, rubber becomes hard and brittle when you super cool it. And like, that's the truth. That's a fact. That's a fact that I will remember for the rest of my life that I learned in a seemingly fictional setting. And like, that's the ideal. That's like the shining beacon of a goal that I amount to in these books and in my science work, is if I can like get people to learn something new in the midst of something else fun and memorable.
Oy, well, you've done a great job. Also, kudos for bringing up Fantastic Four before we wrap up our time.
Aside.
That's amazing. Well, I like that you're in this field where you get to play with that every day. And I know your work at the Center for Cartoon Studies also informs a lot of that, getting to work with cartoonists that are honing those exact skills. So thank you for that, John, for taking the time and the passion that you have and the research that you devoted to pulling this off just right, for teaching me a lot of new things and teaching our readers a lot of new things, and just for creating a book that reads so much so like you had fun doing this. And it's fun to read. So that's not a thing that always happens in nonfiction books. So thank you. It's not even a thing that always happens in comics. It's not always fun reading about real things in comics. So I'm glad that through all of the drafts and through all the work that you did, that you still accomplished the life and the energy and the excitement that you did. Bravo, man.
Well, thank you. That makes me really, that gives me a lot of energy to know that you can feel the fun on that end.
I thought it was wonderful. And I know we talked before recording, and I don't know how much you can say, but I'm glad to know that you're continuing to work with Science Comics on a new entry. Is it public? Are you allowed to share that, or should we save it?
Yeah, they announced it. They announced it with a bunch of other titles in the Science series. The next one I'm doing is the Solar System.
And how far are you into working on the Solar System? Are you still at that research place? Did you meet any astronomers in line at the wedding?
Oh my, yeah, right. Behind the geologist, there was a scientist, an astronomer. Behind them, there was a chemical engineer. Behind them, amazing. Oh, I wish. That would be my party. No, actually, I've been paired off with a writer. I was actually offered to do the Solar System book quite a while ago, and they had a writer already assigned to it. And things happened, and you know, the position of the writer kind of got juggled around. And so it's finally landed back on a wonderful writer named Rosemary Roscoe. It's been so much fun to work with her. The script is really cute. There's a lot of like animals in spacesuits. There's a sassy robot. So there's like everything that I need.
I am in. Sign me up. Yeah. That's wonderful.
But yeah, I'm she's done a lot of research. We're on the second draft of the script. I'm penciling right now. I already did the thumbnails. And today I finished page 80 of the pencils. So I'm chugging right along.
About halfway through. You said they're like 160 pages? Is that what you said?
No, like 120, 124.
Oh, okay. So you're working through it. That's great, man. Well, congratulations on that. That'll come out in a 2018 title?
Yeah, I'd assume so. Yeah, cool. I'm turning it in August, I think.
Good for you.
Thank you.
That's awesome. Well, congratulations on all that and on more work to come and more great comics. And especially you brought up school visits, making those connections with your readers, inspiring them to ask questions, to find answers, to make comics. That's all amazing. I'm grateful for you, John, to know that you're out there doing that.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm grateful for people like you, you know, getting into libraries and getting excited about books and science and kids and stuff.
It's a good life we both live. I think that's for sure. Before I let you go tonight, I want to give you a chance to say a message that can be shared with those readers. I'm going to see a library full of children tomorrow morning. I'd love to know, John, what message I can bring to them from you.
You know, when I go to schools and I talk, the message that I always tell them is again, just like I research this project by going to libraries, I tell them to go to libraries. But since you're going to be seeing the kids in libraries, I guess what I would say to them is I would challenge them the next time they have a question to not look it up on Google. You know, if it's something like, you know, how many movies was Jim Carrey in 1996? Like, I don't know if that's a library question. But like the next time you have just a simple question that, you know, it would be easy to go to Google and say like, well, why is the sky blue? I would say instead, you know, try to answer it by just using the resources of the library, because you might find yourself going down kind of that path of interconnected facts that connect what you didn't know to what you will now know and then kind of lead you to even more interesting connections.
This podcast is recorded and produced by me, Matthew Winner, in my library studio in Ellicott City, Maryland. You can subscribe to the podcast and access the archive of over 250 episodes at All the Wonders, a home for readers to discover new books and to experience the stories they love in wondrous ways. Go beyond the book at allthewonders.com and check out other podcasts from All the Wonders, including the Picture Booking Podcast with Nick Patton, a semi-weekly podcast about picture books and the people who make them, Books Between, a podcast hosted by Karina Allen, helping to connect kids ages 8 to 12 and their parents, teachers, and librarians with books that they'll love, and the Best Book Ever This Week podcast, hosted by me, with book reviews about all sorts of amazing books. Our theme music is by Emily Arrow. All views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the individuals, myself included, and do not reflect ideas or viewpoints of the publishers of the books referred to. Listeners, if this episode connected with you, I'd love to hear it. Leave a comment at allthewonders.com or rate this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher through stars or reviews. Sharing this podcast with friends through Facebook, Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that's a very good thing indeed. Coming up on the podcast, Peter H. Reynolds, creator of The Dot and Ish, shares Happy Dreamer, his newest picture book. See you then, and thanks for listening. We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's K-O-K-O Sleep, and I'll see you there.